que no sé.
To go first today because he will not. Rock and roll. Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for, if you can believe it, March the 29th, 2017. We are gathered together for the purpose of a public hearing on House Bill 5019, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And we're going to go slightly out of sequence and hear from Mr. Ball first, given that he will be unavailable for testimony at the other appointed hour. Mr. Ball, sign in, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair.
Well, actually, before you start, I should turn to our professional staff and say, Ms. Deister, is there anything you want to tell us about this budget before we begin?
Well, certainly, Madam Co-Chair. Members, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is a 100% other funds agency. Their funding comes from liquor sales, beer and wine tax proceeds. It comes from licensing fees associated with the regulation of recreational marijuana. And it comes from licensing fees for liquor licensees as well. So basically, those dollars come in to the agency, gross revenue, they deduct the cost of goods sold, the cost of inventory, generally speaking, distilled spirits. They deduct the cost of their operations. Beer and wine tax is a portion of that is utilized for specific purposes via statute. The balance goes in to the other pot along with liquor distilled spirits revenues, and then whatever's left over after expenses and after those other statutory appointed, this is the Cliff Notes version, by the way, those statutory appointed uses gets distributed to the general fund 56%, and then to cities and counties, to mental health, and to the Oregon Wine Board. So in a sense, they are another funded agency, but they are the third largest contributor to the state's general fund in terms of because of their liquor sales. So,
and I like to think of some of us on the booze side as investors in the
We do it for the kids.
Shareholder,
you know?
Yeah. Shareholder here.
So anyway, that is kind of helps frame the discussions, I think, a little bit if you are perhaps less familiar with the agency. Marijuana is a relatively more recent book of business, and as you will be hearing today, projections with regard to the number of licenses that are assumed to be issued by the end of this biennium and the number of outstanding applications currently in the queue are far higher than was projected at the close of the 2015 legislative session. Or even the 2016 legislative session, and that is likely to drive some additional enforcement costs for the agency, and the number of licensees drives enforcement costs and licensing costs, et cetera. So that is creating, they've been in a constant state of adaption, I would say, for about two biennia now, and they have been utilizing many means at their disposal, including borrowing staff from the liquor side of the equation to help staff up the initial rollout of the marijuana program. And we are fast approaching the point where that will no longer be tenable on a going forward basis. So I think you're going to hear about some of those issues today. It's worth noting that the governor's budget assumes doubling the per bottle surcharge fee from the current rate of 50 cents to $1, and it also assumes a doubling in agency liquor side licensing fees except for service permits.
Ms. Deister, may I interrupt you and ask you to explain that, because not only do we have new people to the committee who may not know how that doubling of the per bottle works, and I would very much like you to explain the role that the commission plays mm-hmm. in that particular set of activities.
Okay. Before I do that, it is worth noting that the co-chair's existing resources framework does not assume those two resources. It assumes things at the current level. So, with regard to the per bottle surcharge, several biennia ago, I believe it was 2009. Yep. Oregon Liquor Control Commission instituted, the commission itself instituted a 50 cent per bottle surcharge. And it has been renewed by the commission every biennium since then. And basically, those dollars are statutorily directed to go directly to the general fund. They do not; they are not split amongst cities and counties like the rest of the liquor revenue.
I might just add a historical footnote. I was one of the negotiators on that, and the original conversation would have dedicated that money to OSP. That regrettably got lost in the mists of time. Please continue.
Well, that was basically, I mean, unless there was...
Senator Monroe.
And historically speaking, 40 years ago in 1977, when I was a freshman state representative, was the last time we raised the tax on beer. And yet they keep piling on the hard liquor and so on. Our tax on wine is relatively high, but we've never raised the tax on beer, which remains 0.6 cents per bottle.
Thank you, Senator.
And that would be a good source of funding for OSP as well.
With that, any questions, colleagues? We are going to turn to Mr. Ball. I need to briefly excuse myself to participate in a phone call that will take about 5 minutes. I will return.
Chair Gomberg.
Indeed.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dustin Ball, and I'm with the Chief Financial Office. I have a brief presentation today that will give you a high-level overview of the governor's budget as it relates to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. As I move through, feel free to stop me if you have any questions, and we can address those. Or the agency is going to have a day and a half, maybe 2 days of testimony and a presentation, and if there are questions come up for me as well during that process, I will be in the room, and we can address those at that point. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission is tasked with administering the Liquor Control Act and cannabis regulation. This includes purchasing, warehousing, and distributing distilled spirits in the state. They oversee retail liquor agents. They regulate the recreational marijuana program, and they oversee Oregon's bottle bill. Issues that OLCC is facing in the upcoming biennium include retail expansion, as well as continued implementation of the marijuana regulation. What we're looking at on this slide is a brief history of the agency's expenditures. On the far left is going to be the 13-15 actuals. The middle column is going to be the current biennium's legislatively approved budget, and the far right is the governor's proposed budget for 17-19. And what you're going to see is steady growth over the period of time that we're looking at, and that is attributable to several factors, which include infrastructure investments, the addition of marijuana regulation, as well as some retail expansion efforts that the agency is undergoing in the current and 17-19 biennium. When we take a look at the expenditures by category, and this is the governor's proposed budget that we're looking at, you'll see that roughly 25% of the agency is personnel related. This is personal services, and 75% is services and supplies. It's important to note that within that services and supplies category is the agent's compensation, and that is a large dollar amount. That's $127 million roughly that maintains the average payout percent of 8.93% to the retail liquor agents in the state. This slide here is going to show us the breakout of revenue sources. The bottom is the current biennium's projections, and the top is the projections included in the governor's budget. And what you're going to notice, I'll call out three things on here. One is the liquor sales. That's the big blue bar. That's increasing quite a bit in the governor's proposed budget, and there are a couple factors in there. One is continued growth in revenues and sales of distilled spirits within the state. And the other factor is we project that the retail expansion efforts that are currently underway at the commission will generate an additional 3% in revenues in the next biennium. When we look at the bottle surcharge, that's that gray bar. On the top, it's mislabeled. It says 50 cent per bottle surcharge. The governor is proposing that be increased to $1 per bottle. And the dollar amount there is right at the $73 million, and that is dedicated to the general fund. And then the other one I'll call out is the licensing fees and permits.
Excuse me, a question, Representative Meek?
Yeah, so just clarification on that. So you said it's going to be the proposed funds of $73 million is based on a dollar per bottle or the 50 cents per bottle right now?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Meek, the $73 million figure that you see on the slide is based on $1 per bottle surcharge. The bottom section of that in the current biennium, that's based on 50 cent per bottle surcharge. It's mislabeled on the top. That should say $1 per bottle surcharge.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The last piece I want to call out on here is the licensing fees, permits, and fines. You'll see that jumping from the current biennium of roughly $15 million up to $22 million in the governor's proposed budget, and that is related to a proposed increase in alcohol-related licensing fees. When we look at the revenues that are coming in, this year is going to give you an idea of where those revenues are going out. And when we look at the alcohol-related licensing or related fees, this is your liquor, beer, wine, all those fees and revenues get distributed to fund the Oregon Wine Board, mental health, alcoholism, drug services account. Then there's distributions that are made to the general fund, cities, and counties. When we look at the revenue from the marijuana side of the house, all those revenues come in, they pay for basically just agency operations. The tax revenue collections and distributions are now handled at Department of Revenue, so those are not within the commission. Key investments included in the governor's budget are two positions to support retail expansion efforts on the liquor side. We have a continuation of one limited duration position that is intended to assist during the appeal process during the initial licensing phase of the marijuana regulation, and providing additional enforcement position to support the needs in the Southern Oregon region. These are those revenue adjustments I called out on the prior slide, where we are in the governor's budget proposing to increase liquor sales by 3% and increase the projections by 3% related to the retail expansion efforts, assuming that the commission will take action to increase the bottle surcharge from 50 cents up to a dollar and increasing those alcohol-related licensing fees. We also made statewide adjustments, which include DAS price list and state government service charges, as well as adjustments to the attorney general rates. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Senator Monroe.
Okay. The agency can increase the tax on liquor by your own action, right? You don't have to have legislation to do that.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Monroe, that is correct.
And I contend that's why we haven't done likewise with the 40-year-old tax on beer, because that would require a vote of this body. Is that correct? I'm getting nods.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Monroe, that is correct. It's a statutory rate.
And in terms of the taxes, overall fees on alcohol, beer is by far the lowest, minuscule compared to the per buzz factor tax on hard liquor, and it's significantly lower than even the tax on wine. We just need to know that, because if we're looking for more revenue, we ought to look at the cash cow that hasn't been milked for 40 years.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions?
But I'll tell you what I really think.
Thank you again, Senator. All right, Mr. Ball, did you have anything more to share with us?
No, Co-Chair Gomberg, that is it. This, to Senator Monroe's point, this slide here, I backed up. This is slide number 5. And you can see the privilege taxes. This is what was referenced when talking about the privilege taxes on beer and wine. It's that green bar. It's the second right above the liquor sales. It's the $38 million is the projected revenues that would be generated during the next biennium from those privilege taxes.
I'd like to know the volume of beer sold in this state versus the volume of hard liquor. You can see a significant difference in the length of the bars.
No pun intended.
Mr. Mark, is that something that that you might be able to get for us in the next day or so? All right.
Question.
Before you leave, Mr. Ball, yes, Representative.
Some days I feel like I'm very new here compared to one who's been here for 40 years, but doesn't it seem like that would be in the, wouldn't it be within the purview of the legislature to give authority to the OLCC to raise that beer tax?
I don't know if we could do that. Just grant them the authority, or if we'd have to actually pass a bill.
Well, that's what I kind of thought a bill might be involved. But.
Pass a bill to grant them the authority.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Reardon, the current privilege tax is set in statute, and the agency does not have the ability to raise that tax beyond what is in statute.
But a senator or somebody could do that, introduce such a bill.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Reardon, I believe that would be correct.
Okay, thank you.
It would have to start in the House.
Oh, okay.
All right. Again, thank you, Mr. Ball, and we will see you back at another time. I'm going to invite Mr. Marks to come up, and while he's coming up, I'll just indicate for Representative Reardon's purposes that that in 1981, when I was here as a legislative aide, fresh out of college, the good Senator Monroe had as much seniority as you and I do today. Mr. Marks, welcome to you and your team.
Thank you. For the record, Steve Marks, I am the executive director of the OLCC. With me is Bill Schutte, our economist. Pleasure to be here today. So we'll just jump right in. But I do want to say that I know that Senator Monroe's service here has not been contiguous over all that time. When I started off with Senator Kitzhaber in 1985, I think we first met. So
I've served 23 years out of the last 40.
Thank you. So with that, OLCC, we're, our landscape is changing, we're growing, we've had a lot of new responsibilities. With that, we have a new mission. And if you had looked at our old mission, it talked about sales and service of alcohol and responsibility, and we haven't lost those values one iota. But we think this mission that was worked on agency-wide reflects what OLCC really does, and that's to support businesses. We license a lot of business. We run a business, and we support businesses that we contract with to sell liquor. We work with public safety and community livability. We are present throughout the state many hours during the day till 2 a.m. in bars. And work at, you know, significant community events all around Oregon. And we do so, get this compliance through education and enforcement of both the marijuana and liquor laws. You know, this has been a growing part of Oregon's economy. I think this mission reflects the importance of our work to that industry that is producing the jobs. The wineries, the breweries, the brew pubs, the distilleries, the restaurants, every community festival and event is almost a part of something that we license now. And so we've taken that part of our mission to heart, and we recognize that it still interfaces intricately with the support of community safety and community livability. So with that, a little overview. We're the third largest generator of funds for the state of Oregon. Comes in after income tax and lottery. We centrally purchase, warehouse, and distribute distilled spirits through OLCC agent contract stores. We appoint and manage the contract retail stores. Actually, our commission does that directly. We do an evaluation and they select. We have 254 current retail outlets. And as Dustin outlined for you, we have plans for continued expansion over the next biennium. We hope to extend that to 310 retail outlets. We license, regulate, and enforce alcohol and marijuana production and sales. We issue the service permits for the folks that serve alcohol and for workers that work in marijuana facilities. And we implement the bottle bill and approve redemption centers. And I'll just say on that last one, I didn't even realize when I came in my service to the state that we had the bottle bill. We don't have a lot of responsibilities around the bottle bill, but they're important ones. We have really limited authorities around it, but you know the redemption is going up to 10 cents on April 1. So. Very good. Moving on, we have these are the statutes that guide our activities for both alcohol and marijuana and our administrative procedures. So we've cited them for you. Statewide offices. The big stars reflect our regions, our regional offices. The small stars are our satellite offices. We have our headquarters and the warehouse for distilled spirits is in Milwaukee, Oregon. And we serve, you know, through that network, every county, every city, every state with services. So we got a lot of geography to cover throughout Oregon with our responsibilities. We've had challenges in the current budget, a lot of challenges in the current budget. We've done a lot of work over the last 2 years. Importantly, you gave grant us about $5 million to install a new conveyor system to increase our shipping capacity out of our Milwaukee facility that was operational in July. And we managed 11% biennial growth with the utilization of that system. It was a tremendous investment for us, and I would note that we installed the system without missing a shipping day. If any of you come up and visit and see how much physical space that took, it was a pretty remarkable exercise. But we got it done, and we're proud of the work there, and we'll talk later about the efficiency gains that that brought to our operations and the benefits it'll bring to long-term revenue stability for the state as our population grows. We completed our roof replacement. You allocated about $5 million for that. And I'll say for the members that weren't here, these are some of the first big capital investments in OLCC in some time. So the legislature put $10 million in capital investments into us. It was greatly appreciated and bought pretty immediate benefits. Our new roof did hold up in the snowstorm, and our old roofs held up that were repaired as well, so we were thankful for that. We still have work to do there. We'll be coming back probably next biennium with a continuing plan to make sure that we take care of that infrastructure.
Aren't you glad I walked in just about the time you started talking about that damn roof? Did I hear you correctly that you're going to come back next session and ask for yet more money for that roof? What's gone wrong this time?
No, if you'll remember, we replaced the full roof on the Millport facility up above, so that was the big replacement. You also provided for an ability to do repairs to the lower roof. We've got two-year guarantees on those repairs, and we wanted to spend some time looking at our overall infrastructure plan before we came back to you again, both capital in terms of the infrastructure having to do with the operations statewide, but at the warehouse facility, and also plans related to IT investments. So we want to come back with plans that show the investments we want to make in our facilities to operate into the future.
How's the roof going?
The roof held up in that snowstorm. It was fantastic. We got that done.
If it hadn't, Mr. Director, you should have been shining up your resume.
I was prepared. Actually, we got one little phase with the rain stopping where the contractors are going to go in and finish up some of the repairs they did on the lower roof. But project's done, complete. We're not asking for any more money for the roof this time. Thank you very much for what you did, and thanks for the investment that helped prevent the collapse of that roof up there. I think actually that upper roof, given the deterioration of what we found, we came to the emergency board earlier, that roof would have been significantly compromised.
Colleagues, to let you in on what appears to be an inside joke, is that the agency missed the estimate by a lot. And we had some issues and some very lively conversations about errors and omissions insurance and proper estimating and those sorts of things. So I'm glad to know that it's all okay.
But these problems, Madam Co-Chair, had nothing to do with the contents of the warehouse.
No. No, and some of us were motivated to go the extra mile to fix the roof, given the precious nature of the internal contents. Please continue, Mr. Marks.
So about a year ago, we initiated expansion of our liquor process. That's a new process we put in place. Old days, OLCC'd, and very infrequently would pick a location and say, gee, we'd like a store there, that community, that area needs to be served, and then we'd put out the notice for people to compete to get that single location. Today, what we do and the process we changed and initiated last year is we open up a geography, and we ask businesses to come in and propose to us what they think works for retail. So it's more market-driven process. It's competitive process. We're very careful with, you know, working with our existing agents and making sure that it doesn't affect them or step on them too much as we go forward. We know it does have some limited effects, but the Commission's been very diligent sort of meting out this process of expansion. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. We've developed the online alcohol licensing system. You give us limited funds, $200,000, $300,000 to help us do some planning to put that together. We had initiated a project much like our experience on marijuana licensing with NIC USA. What we realized is we needed to change our approach. We are changing our approach, and we'll talk about how we're going to initiate the first phase of that is service permits on the alcohol side and how we can execute that project over time. We shared resources to implement marijuana. It was all hands on deck for us. We spent a lot of time doing marijuana licensing. We did use alcohol enforcement licensing people to help us deal with what became a steady supply of licenses to an overwhelming number of licenses that were coming in just about the same rate we were putting them out from October till February. So continuing on the marijuana initiatives and challenges in 2015-17.
Before you continue, Mr. Marks, Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I go back to the previous slide? Yeah. So you had a conveyor system that we installed. So, and as I understand it, that made your operation much more efficient. What do you do with the efficiency on that? Do you reduce the headcount, or do you increase services to your customers, or what do you do with the efficiency, with the gains?
I'm going to let Bill start that, and then I'm going to add to it.
Yes, co-chairs, committee members, for the record, Bill Schutte, economist with the Liquor Control Commission. Most of what we gained so far in the conveyor system has been in operation for about 8 months now, have been efficiencies. We've reduced increased our hourly output from about 900 cases per hour up to 1,500 cases per hour. That has shortened the shipping window considerably. On average, we were shipping about 14 hours a day. Now it's down to close to 10 hours a day. Cost savings, we have yet to see a lot, but we have seen, looking at December of this year from December of last year, because of the shortened shipping window, we saw about a 20% reduction in overtime. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing some cost savings, but this really was a project for the future to make sure we get the capacity and meet the needs of the liquor stores out there.
You know, we're learning to fine-tune that. We haven't got every efficiency out of that system. We now are operating it and about down to a 1% error rate, which is comparable. We're a little lower than that with the old system. So we're moving forward. But there's very few things you'll ever get a vote on here that have this kind of return on investment for the state. I'm excited to have been just a part of it because I've done a lot of work on different things, and this one that you can see it. You know, this system, with its capacity to do 3 to 5 doors, is going to serve Oregon's population over the next, you know, decade, likely. You know, if you look at the billions of dollars of sales that's going to go through there, about $7 billion, probably return something like $3.5 billion over that period to the state. So a very good investment that is helping us operate efficiently and will help us meet that growing population demand.
Thank you.
Thank you. Marijuana initiatives and challenges in 2015-17, we developed and deployed 3 major IT systems. We did the online marijuana licensing, we developed the cannabis tracking system, and we did the service worker permit system. We moved very quickly to deploy these systems. We put, from the end of last biennium, these were put together in less than 6 months in some instances when we had to initiate them. They have worked well with us. I'd say we had good experiences with our contractors. We have, given this pace and speed, our approach has been that we're adapting the back-end systems. We're finding things that we need to refine in all of them, in the cannabis tracking system and in the licensing system. Our contractors have had the capability to do that, but, you know, we've got to plan in those changes as we move forward. So it's been a matter of some adaptation. We certainly have some improvements to be made, but up, functional, working, and serving us and the state well right at the moment.
Have you done any economic modeling or marketplace modeling about how long until we hit a point where there are more shops than there are smokers?
Co-Chair Johnson, you know, we haven't done, we did some early on modeling about how much consumption was taking place in Oregon, how much of the population, but, you know, the system we have for licensing isn't based on that. It's an all-commerce qualifications-based system. We do the background checks. They bring their investors. We check them. We do the check off with local government, and then the statute has us approve licenses. For us, we foresee, because of the rapid growth, that we will be oversupplied for our system, that enforcement issues will be vital to us as we go forward, and that there will be some shakeout inside our licensee system in the coming in the next few years.
And a follow-up, how much pressure are you getting from the folks that are trying to do this legitimately about the regulatory burden that you're putting on them? And if you can believe everything you read in the press, which I certainly don't, but Oregon continues to be a top black market source of marijuana. What's the attitude of the people that are subject to all of the regulation and are trying to do everything legally, and they've got somebody down in the corner selling a gunny sack full of weed?
So I will say this. The folks that decided to come into our system were committed to the legal business. By and large, I believe that. I've seen it. They've come in with their investments. They want to meet the rules. They've gone through incredible expense to be a part of the legal system. They are very concerned both about the illegal growings of marijuana and also the system that we have currently for OMMP, the medical program in Oregon. They are concerned about diversion. We have seen in a lot of the reports we get on illegal operations, which we don't have authority over, but which we work with local law enforcement and state law enforcement on, we're seeing a lot of more instances of them pointing out who those operators are, if you will, diming them out to us. So we get a lot of calls from the industry itself, the new licensed Oregon industry, to focus on illegal grows. They would like to see more of investment. But, you know, with some of the changes in the statutory law and decriminalization of some of the marijuana statutes, that'll make things more difficult. For instance, transportation, and they fixed it, but at one point went down to a very low misdemeanor for pretty large amounts of marijuana. So I think there was a change made in that that'll be more helpful. The other focus here is the legal community often turns to law enforcement and doesn't feel like they're focused on those illegal growers, and that's rightly so. In a lot of distressed Oregon rural communities, and even in the urban centers, marijuana is not the highest priority for law enforcement. They have been great partners for us. When we need them, they work with us on the issues that we face. But there are challenges here in getting to the illegal and black market. We view our role in marijuana production is to provide Oregonians with a we now have medical products inside our system, too. They can be produced by our licensees, sold at our retail, but they all come from the tracked OLCC system. We view our responsibility to run a system that creates no diversion itself and gets no inversion from illegal, the illegal market. We don't have great responsibilities outside of it or direct authorities, but we have great concern about that. And we work with those issues and law enforcement to control that as best we can.
How do you find your partnership with OHA? And let me preface my question by saying, I think OHA has taken on so many responsibilities. Does it still make sense to have two state agencies, actually more DORs involved in it? It seems as though there are pockets of marijuana throughout all of our agencies. Does this make sense?
So to answer as directly as I can, and, you know, if I had ever talked 2 years ago, if I talked about medical marijuana, it'd be heresy. Today I can more so because I think there's an evolution of thought. The commission does, and we have maintained for some time that, you know, licensees and marijuana growers shouldn't pay for duplicative systems. So there's that just basic efficiency argument. There's also the argument for consolidation about compliance with the pretty ephemeral Cole Memorandum that was U.S. Department of Justice advice to the states. And, you know, out of that, we have determined that our OLCC system, we wanted it to be as Cole compliant as possible. That's why we have a cannabis tracking system. There's reporting daily. We can see it online. There were steps taken to track in the medical system, but it's a monthly reporting system. It's paper. It's slower. So there's both, I think, public safety and efficiency reasons for the state to consider a single operating system.
Please continue.
Rural development. We did a lot of rural development. You passed laws, so we had the ballot measure. We passed one law in 15, another law in 16, amending that and changing that pretty significantly. So we went through a lot of rural development for the base system that we put in place. We had rules, permanent rules moving through, and then we amended them with temporary rules, and I think we got done in November of last year with a sort of final of the big lift on rulemaking. That process actually went remarkably well for us with the regulated community. We spent a lot of time working with the regulated community to get it done. In the end, very few of those licensees actually showed up at our adoption. We did have some issues with the hemp growers who wanted access to our stores. And at that time, when we were considering it, hemp was less regulated by the federal government than it is today. So we dealt with that issue, but remarkably smooth on the end, and proud of the work we were able to do. Those rules have served us well. They're not perfect. We've dealt with a lot of unique situations in trying to license and put these licensees out in the world, but it's functioned well.
Forgive me, Senator Hansel.
Just a quick question. I notice on this slide you've processed 1,000, or I guess approved 1,052, and this great volume of getting them online. Have you found that, I know it's a short time, but they're already ones that you have to pull back now? Or have anybody come forward and then not meet muster and have to?
Kutcher Johnson, Senator Hansel, we have had a few, very few. We are having enforcement issues flagged now, and we need to investigate. We have, Jesse, two instances where we have revoked licenses?
Pending.
Yeah, that we're currently in process on. We've issued other violations. We've denied a few service permits, to date, most of those folks are up, functioning, and in good stead in our system. So I was on that point. We predicted about 1,000 license applications. We've got over, 2,287. That was probably as of a couple days ago. It could have grown by 20 by now. We have produced and put out over 1,000 licenses. So, we've the work has doubled. And just to augment that point, our work is doubling, and we are coming up for the first renewals of the annual licenses for all marijuana growers. This is an emerging industry. They're changing their business organizations and structures. They're changing their operations on the farm. This relicensure isn't going to be business as usual. We expect that we're going to have to go out and do a lot of field inspections and relicensing. And so that's going to actually increase our workload in next biennium around these issues because we'll – yes.
Are there issues for your folks going, quote, out into the field? I'm told by some of my colleagues that places like portions of Douglas, Jackson, Josephine – are kind of the Wild West, and in terms of marijuana grows, and I am repeating anecdotal information. I have no firsthand knowledge of this, but I wonder about the safety of your employees heading out into the hills, around Roseburg. How's that working out for you,
Co-Chair Johnson? So, I think that we had concerns as we were initiating the program, that our staff had concerns. We've, tailored our program so a lot of the initial licensing and inspection was done by that inspector that was going to come out later and take a look at your property or be responsible for ensuring your compliance, so they got to know them. We organized this way specifically so that we could ensure that we had good access and good communication. I have not had a report to me from an inspector where they really felt endangered by going out to the marijuana fields.
Good.
It's pretty comfortable for them. Certainly there are bars in this state where they feel danger. I haven't heard those same kind of reports around anyone
Good.
Going out on a marijuana field. And then we're identifying a lot of compliance concerns, and I'll talk more specifically about those compliance concerns down the line in our presentation. OLCC's organizational structure, this is the current structure, and we have public safety as a main unit that has most of our employees. We have administration and support services, that includes the director's office. We have distilled spirits. Which is, all the way from our retail to the warehouse to distribution, and then marijuana. Marijuana is actually sort of a shrinking program because one of the things that we're working at doing is integrating the marijuana and alcohol programs under our existing structure, our existing management, and into our existing units of operations. That's why you see marijuana green boxes at the bottom of public safety and in administration and support services. The marijuana function on the end is doing a lot of policy work. It's doing analysis and working with the cannabis tracking system. But inspectors are doing inspector-like work, and we're having a management through and in public safety and in financial services, where we do a lot of work around audits, compliance with the system. This reflects about 264 FTE and about $61 million that you spend on the people that power all the organization.
Senator Hanson.
Yeah.
I get about 36 members of your staff, if I counted up correctly, on the green boxes that are dealing with marijuana. Is that about right?
37.
Yeah. 37. So we'll be going through each of the programs in a bit more depth here. So on the distilled spirits program, I think you get a good sense of what we do. We centrally purchase and receive all the liquor. We distribute it statewide. We do the contracting with our agents and distillery agents. And distillery agents, I think we have maybe a slide or more information, are growing rapidly. They've been one area of growth for us that we've had to add in. And some of those distilleries not just produce product, but we have a distillery retail outlet license, so they can sell their products right directly on site. Also, because we make provisions for transfers, can transfer small quantities directly to a retail store for sale in the community.
I don't want to pass by that lightly, because that was a big deal.
Yeah.
It was, for our new colleagues, this was a system of tradition unhampered by progress, and driving some of these products.
You said that last time we were here, Senator.
Well, but it's gotten,
it made an impression, didn't it?
It's gotten better, and somehow loading a bottle of tequila from a little local distillery and taking it for a ride to Milwaukee, and then manhandling it in the shop, and then putting it back on a truck and taking it for another little ride back up to Astoria so somebody can carry it across the street is nuts. And you've gone a long ways towards helping that, particularly as some of the distillers are quite entrepreneurial and expansive in their product selection. I have some folks in my district that are infusing very, very rich ice cream with booze, and you help make it possible for them to get into retail outlets. It's expanded their business. And so I just want to use this opportunity, as much as I whoop up on him, to applaud the director for at least looking at fixing some of this stuff.
Let me just follow up on that retail, the shipping point, because we did, Senator Johnson served on a task force we had 2 years ago during the interim, along with other members, and identified this issue for us. And we were handling it as sort of a one-off situation. We had our district managers, and sometimes they would affect the transfer in the field, but it wasn't systemic. So we took a look at what we could do, and instead of running it by our policy, we went out and did rulemaking. There are concerns about self-distribution of alcohol. Obviously, the distributor is very concerned about the growth in this, so we had a focused process to create the limits around this. So as we had a conversation with Senator Hansel, and who has a distiller in his district who had a follow-up interest in our rulemaking, we have a 75-mile limit because we didn't want to have to deal with a ton of these, because it's a manual process for us with our IT systems. When they transfer it at the store in the remote locale, we have to have someone on the other end of the phone enter it into the computer system and then take it out, because otherwise it looks like it's available for sale everywhere in the state. So we've worked past that. We've got a limited number of transfers. We've put this system together, and it's going to work well for us, but it was focused to be a very limited opportunity, and an opportunity to allow, a lot of places, South Coast in particular, there was someone operating there that really wanted to just do a little business in the community, and that was the business model they were on, and that was fantastic for them. The benefit when a small distiller grows a little bit, though, of our system, and it's a big benefit, is once you get more cases in our door and you start having a successful product that's selling, you get statewide distribution through OLCC. So it's a big boon to this whole movement around distilleries and the economic benefits that distilleries can derive through OLCC distribution.
But thank you for at least taking a look at it, making some small inroads. It's much appreciated, and previous directors had turned a deaf ear to it, and I appreciate your entrepreneurial approach to it.
Thank you. We do a lot of training and support work. One of the focuses we've had over recent years is support work with our contract agents. Since I've been there in 2 years, we have done annual trainings. We bring in some of the best sales marketers in the world around alcohol products. We've also had a focus on gaining deeper knowledge of our sales of the contract, our retail operations around specific alcohol products. We did whiskey 2 years ago. Last year we did tequila. This year I think we're doing scotch, and we've had the benefit of bringing in some of the master distillers from all around the United States and America. It's been really well received. We are reaching out further to try to not just educate the owners of the store, but also to provide opportunities for their staffs regionally to have them advance a depth of knowledge. We're also cognizant that they need data from sales out of our systems, and we're working to make that more ubiquitous, more accessible to them so that they can maximize their own businesses.
Senator Hansel.
I'm assuming that Roundup Whiskey continues to be well marketed. Is that correct?
But whiskey does well, Senator.
The Roundup brand.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Right. Just want to make sure.
And by some local firms as well.
Please continue.
So we work to make sure the inventories are right, that we don't have too much product. We own the product that we send out to our agents, so it's state property while it's out there. We look to make sure that they have the right varieties of liquor and the right sort of inventories in place. Obviously, we have issues as we manage the warehouse. We have a bailment warehouse, so just so you understand, manufacturers actually own most of the liquor inside our warehouse until we ship it or we break the case to repack it. Then the state buys it, and it's our property until sold by a retail agent. At that point, they send us the total dollars for the sale, and we send them back at the end of the month compensation. We have statewide uniform liquor pricing. It's based in liquor gets priced. We have a formula, and manufacturers usually back into the price point that they want to be within the market. So there's some flexibility for manufacturers in understanding the consistent formula that we have for the markup on liquor. And then we educate and make sure our stores themselves are compliant. Goals for the distilled spirits program: we want to continue the retail expansion, obviously. We also want to not forget about the backbone of our system, our existing agents that generate the bulk of the revenue that you've seen in the bar charts. We want to make sure that we're more convenient to customers throughout this state, that we provide a more modernized shopping experience to customers, and that we meet demands of Oregon's growing population. I'll just note, last biennium, in our budget consideration process, you asked us to make sure that our compensation formula remained equal as agents moved from a status of exclusive sales for spirits to a status of non-exclusive where they're selling beer and wine. And that's a model that is working well in the Oregon system today. And we removed the disincentive or the penalty in our compensation formula if these businesses went to non-exclusive and sold beer and wine, and usually that involves some upgrades of the facilities they have. It's resulting in those upgrades. We're seeing it across the state. Agents are adopting that model. If you go out to Kaiser, we've got one of our new feature liquor stores under the new system that is coming out there and moved out of old barred up chalet retrofit. So we're moving forward with this, and that change that you asked for last time is making a difference in our system, and our agents are stepping up and making investments. So that's thank you for that. We've talked about the expansion and the numbers we're hoping to get to. I would say that 310 is not so much of a specific target, because I described this self-driven process of some of those proposals that we might want to take advantage of, maybe small retail outlets, some may be larger, but we'll talk about going across the geography of Oregon and then continuing to round out and balance what the needs are here. So it's more of an expression of something around that level is what we're going to try to hit, and we'll, in working with our agents and working with the proposals we get and the kind of investments we get, we'll see if we match that and match our expectations for revenue production as well. We want to increase our capabilities to use business analysis and data to work our business. From everything we do, you know, now that we got such an advanced conveyor system, you know, our time is all moved up. Things are moving faster all the way around. Our logistics are much more important today. For instance, to gain the kinds of efficiencies in using that, you need three trucks with three loads that are relatively the same size. Works out better for loading. So we're and we use common carriers, by the way, for our shipping. But using data to support what's selling in the market, making sure we understand what that is, and refining our abilities to manage the costs inside our system are born out of data and more developing more capabilities there. We want to keep pace, as I mentioned, with distillery and distillery retail outlets. We'll have figures on the growth later on in the presentation. We want to facilitate, as we mentioned, the distillery transfers, and we want to continue to optimize the conveyor systems operation. And with that, we'll begin to look at the forecast of gross liquor sales, and Bill will take over here.
So on the subject of liquor, of course, it's the majority of our revenues coming into the state, the sale of liquor. On average, the gross liquor sales have increased about 5% per year. Forecasting out at the current service level, we're assuming that same amount of growth, of course, pending any sort of economic issue or recession. In 17-19, as Mr. Ball pointed out, we have two different forecasts. So we have $1.31 billion at the current service level with none of the initiatives proposed in the governor's recommended budget, and $1.39 billion with all the initiatives proposed in the governor's recommended budget. There's about a $75 million gap in there, and I will address each one of those initiatives individually later in the presentation.
Retail outlets, just a visual representation of all of our liquor stores throughout Oregon. Does not include distillery retail outlets. But you can see we have a concentration about, you know, 60% of our market is in sort of that Portland metropolitan three-county area. So the warehouse that we have is situated to help us into the future for sure.
As Mr. Director, as you look to expand retail spots, do you take into consideration any radii around a spot so that you're not crowding existing retailers?
The answer to that is yes. Bill, we didn't put in place any specific requirement around it, but we take it into account. We look at it. We make sure that the commission members see who's going to be affected or who's close, or the mileage from another retailer if we have a proposal come in. And not only do we look at the mileage from another retailer, in some areas the new entrants are sort of proposing three stores closely together. So we have to analyze those as well, and they may lose out because we'll choose the commission, you know, select the best one out of the three, or what their view is of the best pitch. You know, these folks come in and they make direct interviews, direct pitches, come in with a pro forma on their investments, and then testify directly to the commission about what their capabilities and experience are.
Senator Hanson.
Do you do the same thing, Mr. Director, with siting of marijuana outlets, or is that more local jurisdiction? I mean, I go down State Street, and goodness gracious, there's a shop every two or three every block, it seems like.
Co-chairs, Senator Hansel, so all those aren't ours. Some of those are OHA ones. No, and the answer is no. The statute doesn't provide us the discretion on it. They do provide local time, place, and manner regulations for local governments, and there's a requirement to be 1,000 feet away from a school. This has really helped space in some of the smaller communities in Oregon, really helped space, but that's, you know, part of the reason you see some concentration in Salem is we have a lot of churches there. If you look around, so some of those areas that are 1,000 feet away are pretty limited properties.
Good. Thank you.
You and I have talked about this before, and that is, as the commission makes decisions, and I still think that's a pretty opaque process, to what degree do you reach out to get any local lore? I'm thinking that most of us sitting up here on this panel know our towns really, really, really well. And what effort is made to reach out and say, what do you know about this? Or is it all done in Salem behind a closed door?
Co-Chair Johnson, not all done in Salem behind a closed door, but, you know, there's the opportunity for people to provide input to the commission, obviously. I think most of our sense of what's happening locally comes from our regional district managers who do pay attention, who are out on the ground. They do the work and the review of the proposals, and they actually score and have an internal process at the state level with everyone involved. But I can't say that it's extensive.
I'm going to just give you a little free focus group here. Panel, how many of you know who your regional OLCC person is? Mr. Noble does. That might be by virtue of the fact that he carried a gun and a badge for a long time.
It is.
Does it tell you anything that the rest of us don't have a clue who our person is?
It does.
Thank you.
I do remember at times being around here that they find their way to you if you change their compensation. So,
I'm talking about the OLCC employee. I'm not talking about the liquor.
Oh, sorry. Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
OLCC. Yes.
We will do more work in that regard.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, your concentration in the Portland metro area, does that have anything to do with the price differential between Oregon and Washington?
Bill can talk more specifically about the gains we've had because of privatization and the price differential from Washington, but I do really think the concentration around Portland, it's where the people are in the state. So,
Co-Chair Senator Monroe, there's been relatively little growth with the exception of our retail expansion efforts of new stores opening, but certainly the Portland metro area has gained substantially out of the privatization in Washington. And what is important also is that that gain, which is probably 30% for some stores, 50% for other stores, has not tapered off. The prices have been maintained, and people are still coming across the border to stores like Jansen Beach and Rainier and even some of the stores in the eastern part of the state.
Thank you.
I can attest to the fact that the store in Rainier does a booming business. It's at the end of what is an extension of a city street into another state. Just while we're taking this little break, last time you appeared, we have, again, new colleagues, and you were talking about the revenues depending now more on higher-end, more expensive product. Share with the committee, if you will, what's the highest-end bottle of booze that has gone across the transom in one of your stores? Colleagues, we were stunned to hear the amount the last time, somebody would pay for a bottle of alcohol.
Co-Chair Johnson, Senator, I believe the most expensive one was a McClellan 50-year-old scotch that probably went for
$27,000.
And that was a one-time special purchase order. But we can certainly provide a list of the higher products that are sold on the market out there. But there are many in the market out there that are in the several thousand dollars that are routinely being purchased.
Yeah, that was before my time, but my understanding is they had to do it on two receipts to deal with the numbers there. I will say about our system, we do have the capability, if you are at our store and can't find a product that you want, you can do a spotlight search through our website that can help narrow you down and find the product you want somewhere in the state, and it can be shipped to your agent as well. If there's a product that is not within the state, we will seek out and find a case in the U.S. or the world and bring it to Oregon and try to fulfill that desire.
I've actually used that, and you do it very handily. Senator Monroe.
At the time Washington went to privatization, I heard the argument that Oregon wouldn't be able to, if Oregon followed that pattern, that it would hurt some of the smaller vendors, that, and particularly some of the small Oregon distilleries that maybe don't do the volume, that those products wouldn't be available as they currently are in Oregon. Is it still the case that we have a greater variety of product as well as cheaper prices than they have in Washington?
Co-chairs, Senator Monroe, I'll answer that generally. I'll say yes. The reality is when the privatized markets really do focus on top 100 products, so the smaller folks have a harder time getting in. There are more limited, so the diversity of products competition comes from, you know, specialized liquor stores that develop in the private market.
No. Co-chair Gomberg.
That's true.
Oh, Madam Co-chair, I just feel compelled to point out that that $27,000 bottle would entail about $1,000 in credit card transaction expenses for the state.
Thank you.
How much tax do we get for that?
He reads a lot. He has no firsthand knowledge.
Co-chair Gomberg, I will say that's of some concern to us, and I think that whole credit card charge is part of an anachronism from sort of state stores. You know, we don't sell them our product. We pay for that piece. We send back compensation. One of the things we're committed to do is look at our system and see, you know, what are the costs that should be on those private businesses? What are the costs that should be just a part of our payments and compensation? And I would say that, you know, to have a fair discussion with them, we need to look at compensation, and maybe you just take away all the counting we have to do that 3%, and you push it into the compensation formula. We are inequitable in our credit card charges between our retailers right now. So there's a lot of reasons to consider refining this.
Fair point. Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Retail expansion. This is the visual of where we're going, where we've been, and where we're going to. So we start off in the Tri-County area. Got 14 locations. Went to Lane, Lynn, and Benton. 6 locations. We've approved 20 stores, so that means we got about 43 or so to do this biennium to hit our target. These are all board approved. And the board approved moving into the Central Oregon and Northeast Oregon Phase 3 at their last commission meeting. So we'll be opening up open recruitment there. I think the bid market's going to be pretty interesting competition. We'll go to the lower half of the state, probably in about 6 months' time, beginning of next year, end of this year, and then up into the northeast corner in Senator Johnson's district.
I'm looking at your Zone 4. In that
northwest
are little tiny towns, as well as Medford and some very sizable towns. In the less populated area, do you have any kind of formulaic thoughts? I mean, how far people would be from a liquor store as you entertain applications for new retail outlets?
So Bill can probably tell you average distances out there, but the reality when the commission makes the decisions, they look at really is it a place that they think needs service, and will look at how far away things are, and they'll make their judgment about whether it makes sense. As you know, a lot of the little stores are really service the customer stores. They're not our big money makers, but they make sure that we have distribution of the product throughout the state. We in Lane, Lynn, and Benton counties, we sited a nice store, a small community at SIO, put another one in, and we're seeing some of those proposals in small communities as we open this process up. We also, I think, put one in on the route to the coast through Lane County on the way there. That someone made a proposal and wanted to provide and sell liquor, and we thought they had the wherewithal and a market to do it, and we provided them, the commission provided them that opportunity.
Does every county have at least one liquor store?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
And so staying in our distilled spirits program, there is a policy option package, number 101, proposed in the governor's recommended budget. The overview is Mr. Marks outlined liquor stores are contracted by the OLCC to provide retail outlets for distilled spirits throughout the state. During the 80s, the ratio of outlets to population is 1 to 12,000. Currently, as it stands, it's probably closer to 1 to 15,000, even higher in metropolitan areas, closer to 1 to 25 or 1 to 30,000. During 2016, a retail expansion was launched, anticipating growth from 248 outlets to 310 by the end of the biennium, 17-19 biennium. In addition, Oregon has seen tremendous growth in our distillery outlets. Sales have grown an average rate of 41% per year since inception of Oregon distilleries. So the rationale for the request is the expansion of our liquor stores and distillery agents has created some stresses on the OLCC. Resources to effectively manage and supply and account for the state liquor inventory. District managers currently cover about 50 stores each, not including distillery agents. Retail expansion is projected to add an additional 12 stores per district manager. The additional coverage is more labor intensive due to assistance with opening brand new stores and training brand new agents. So our request through the governor's budget is addition of one district manager to accommodate some of this growth in the liquor and distillery outlets, and the addition of a business analyst, as Mr. Marks alluded to, will assist in evaluating the markets or proposals for expansion.
Have you projected what these new stores will do to your bottom line?
Co-Chair Johnson, yes, we have, and it is just a management estimate based on the increase of outlets moving from the original 248 up to the 310, and we are forecasting a 3% increase in liquor sales, which is in the governor's recommended budget.
A 3%?
3% in gross liquor sales.
Could you monetize that percentage?
It's about $72 million total, and about 39. I have the numbers later in the presentation, but about 39 net.
Okay. All right.
Now on a public safety and licensing program, we approve all kinds of license types and renewals for bars, restaurants, retail stores, distributors, wineries, breweries, brew pubs, distillers, marijuana growers, processors, wholesalers, retailers, and labs. A lot of licensing that we do. We enforce the liquor. This division enforces the liquor and marijuana laws. We do premises visits, minor decoy operations, issue violations, cooperate with local law enforcement through this arm of our program. It includes all our licensing personnel and our investigators and inspectors. We issue and serve alcohol server permits as well as marijuana worker permits and provide for the education of the servers and the marijuana workers. There's some interesting opportunities as we look to go on as we're going online with the issues of the licenses, what we can do with more training and education here online.
Mr. Marks, tell me a little bit about how you recruit your minor decoys.
Well, I'm not the best expert on that. So a lot of the minor decoys, though, do come from local sheriff's operations where they, you know, have some program for youth to be involved with them. So a lot of them volunteer to be minor decoys with us. We do a lot of these operations in conjunction with, you know, city law enforcement and county law enforcement. I think, Bill, do you know specifically we have an application process? I know most of the ones that I've worked with or seen have been recruited out of some local cadet program.
And they are indeed under the age of 21.
And they use proper licensing when they do those operations. I remember this being really controversial when they started it. I was in the governor's office. We had a different director here, and they started going in and doing the minor sales deal, and it was a tough row when they first started that up.
Please, Senator.
I've heard from some of my cohorts in the Washington legislature that since privatization, the incidence of youth getting access to hard liquor has increased rather dramatically. I just wondered about the security of their system in terms of access to young people versus the security in our liquor stores.
So, Co-Chair Senator Monroe, I think when they started off, that was a real big concern, bigger than today. I think a lot of those private businesses have done things much like the control state did to control liquor subsequently when they had, you know, smash and grabs or people pulling bottles out. But they began to bullpen the liquor in one area, you know, make sure that you have somewhere out. So I'd say at the beginning of that process, there was more verifiable stories. I heard more, saw news articles directly related to it. I don't have any particular data I'm drawing on right now, but I do know that I've seen them make improvements. I've seen photographs of the kinds of things that they're changing to under the privatized system there. So more concerns and more definitely at the beginning of that process. I think as they've gotten more experience with it, they've done a little better job.
And Oregon?
And compared to us, you know, it's so whenever we've looked at public safety data and we've tried to look at privatized states and really figured out what their theft rate was, we never get good numbers. They have total shrinkage in their system, and we never have comparable numbers. So I can't tell you directly. We believe we're probably better, but I can't give you an exact data point that says we are.
Senator Monroe, we can get that information for you, but Oregon is extremely low, especially related to the single point of entry for most of the liquor stores. So they're heavily monitored. There's somebody watching, the staff watching the people all the time that are coming in. Especially with a customer service ethic, we're training our liquor store agents to actually engage the customer when they come in so they know they're being observed and watched as well as the customer service.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, well, let's continue. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Reardon.
I've just been curious, and thank you, curious about the degree of training required for someone that's selling or doing a retail position on marijuana versus a liquor store. And I'm much more familiar with the liquor store purchase than the marijuana one. So the products are significantly different.
I'm pleased to hear that.
Co-chairs, Reardon. I don't really believe it's on the ownership, on the licensees themselves versus, so one's a license, our stores are contract owners, but we have bars and restaurants too. We rely on, so they're supposed to be familiar and understand the statutes. We don't test them on that. And so it is their experience in working with us, their responsibility to understand the statutes generally. I'll get you more specific if there's anything out there that detailed that I need to provide you.
Clarification.
Please.
I was trying to get at, and I'm sorry I didn't ask the question very well, the product knowledge, because it seems like alcohol, you can kind of grab a bottle and read the label, you know what it is, but I've seen the newscast of sales going on in stores, and they're just all going to these little glass containers. Is there a special product knowledge, then, and are they tested on that? Or
On the marijuana side, or do they know? So there are people with detailed knowledge about their marijuana products. They, you know, like can describe what it should do for you, what the THC quantity is, what the where it was grown, how it was grown. There's a lot of, just like in the craft brewery industry and the winery industry, they can work up a lot of distinctions about marijuana, the strains, and what it does. It's not our responsibility. We don't do anything, have any relationship to that. We do provide some education around safety and sales and the public safety requirements. But there are very knowledgeable people, and I think it, like any other retail business, there are some that sell that aren't very knowledgeable out there.
Thank you.
Co-chair Representative Reardon, I might add that there is a little bit of a similarity between both programs, and that when you get a license for marijuana or get a liquor agency, you're required to present a control plan. And that control plan is generally a combination of security, cameras, theft deterrence. You know, how are you going to manage the product in both sides of that? So there is, it is a responsibility of the owners, both on the liquor side and the marijuana side, to do that. But they have to present that control plan to us.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So to continue on, we investigate citizen and local government complaints. We get a lot of complaints, and we're driven by those. We certainly follow up on all that come in. A lot of those do involve field work. We have had a special emphasis since I've been there to really try to get compliance through education. I just believe, and we've believed, and it's worked for us, that education is the best bang for the buck for us to make people compliant and to put them in a compliance posture.
Does that extend to your sting operations? Because I know that some of the grocery stores are particularly intolerant to any sting. And that people get fired. A particularly tragic incident that I know is a young woman was just standing in to help for sales for a couple of hours, destined to go to medical school, gets busted in one of your stings. It seems to me that the zero tolerance policy is pretty draconian in some instances where an honest mistake is made by, let's say, a grocery checker. And I'm trying to figure out, if education is the best policy, how does that extend to the retail establishments where somebody gets caught selling underage?
So it's not the exclusive policy. We do have direct bright line standards, and on the sting operations, if they make the sale, they generally almost always get the penalty. We do have in our process in our side of the process, the administrative side, the opportunity to make changes, but sometimes those are referred criminally depending on who does the sting and where it happens.
Okay, so tell me then, how does the education side of this work with servers? Or let me just put it this way. I lived through the FAA saying, we're here to help you, we're from the government, and it had no part of education, it had every part of we're going to bust you. And I'm just trying to figure out where your education and your regulatory collide.
In this case, we've done more outreach with, for instance, wineries. Wineries have a problem with minor decoy operations and had a bit of a failure and didn't really understand that it applied to them, that we could come to them, that it would happen in wineries. We spent a lot of time reaching out to the wineries, the folks that do service in wineries, to understand that they're subject to the sting operations, that they have to met out alcohol within the requirements of service of the LCC. So that's how education, I think, plays into that our minor decoy operations.
Okay. Let's sprint to the next break, and then we're going to run out of time.
So we write a lot of violations. The public safety side really preps all of that, and then it's handed off to a unit called APMP. It's our administrative procedures side, where they actually take the reports that are given to them from our public safety side and then make charges off them.
So on the public safety side, this is where most of our key performance measures are. The first one we'll talk about is our average days to process an alcohol license. In 2016, the average day to process an alcohol license was 78 days. That was up by 6 days from 2015. In 2014, the legislature reduced the target down to 75 days because we consistently met it. What we're thinking is between 15 and 16 is some resources, as Mr. Marks mentioned, were devoted to marijuana, and that may have led to a little more time to process a license. Keep in mind that staff time in this processing is relatively minimal, probably less than 21 days. A lot of the time is spent awaiting local review on the alcohol side. So it's not all in control of the commission, but we do take responsibility for the measure, and we seek to lower the...
How long does that compare to a marijuana license?
Co-Chair Johnson, the marijuana licenses are difficult because they were in a startup phase, but right now we're looking at probably close to 85 or 88 days to process a marijuana license once we got everybody up and going.
So if I buy Betsy's Better Bar from Senator Monroe here, for me to be up and going with a liquor license that is essential to run Betsy's Better Bar, I'm 75 days out.
On average, co-chair, yes.
Okay.
There's a required, that required local review part of the process often takes a lot of the time with the days on the liquor licensing.
Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just curious kind of person. So you mentioned 21 days work, 75 days elapsed time. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little bit on the waiting that takes place and what's happening?
Co-chair is Representative Reardon. The waiting, a lot of it is the local review. City of Portland, for example, can take up to 60 days before they issue an opinion on whether they approve or disapprove of a license being renewed or not. A lot of it can be, and then we found this especially on the marijuana side, can be the owners themselves. They make a decision when they're going to open, and they pull the trigger on the license on that particular day. So it's a combination of both staff time, but also local review and owners waiting as well.
Please. If I wanted to run those processes in parallel, is there anything that would prohibit me from, I want to get my bar up and running quickly, so could I submit something to the City of Portland and your organization at the same time, or do they have to be serial?
Co-chair is Representative Reardon. You have to submit to the Liquor Commission first, and then the City of Portland gets copies of all the liquor applications and posts them on our website.
Okay.
But one thing I just whispered in my ear, with change of ownership, this time can be reduced significantly. There is a process for that if you want to just take over a change of ownership. It doesn't have to go through the full-blown license application process.
Oh, great. Okay.
Good. All right. Transaction. We're good. All right.
The next key performance measure we'll talk about related to public safety is the rate of second violation. This one's a little more difficult to understand, so bear with me. But this one basically looks at repeat offenders. So if a establishment commits a violation within a given year, what percentage of these establishments commit another violation within a two-year period? So this is a combination of enforcement but also education efforts. In 2016, the rate was 14%. This was up a little bit from 12% in 2015. The target is 12%. It's a little bit back-looking, so you know it takes time for these things to catch up. But we really are looking for incidents of repeat offenders and the effectiveness of follow-up education and enforcement visits.
Okay. This will be the last one, and then we'll break and take it up tomorrow.
And then our last key performance measure related to public safety, of course, is our minor decoy compliance rate. In 2016, the rate, when you go in to send a decoy into a store, there was a 81% chance of not making a sale. So unfortunately, on the other side, that means there's a 19% of the establishments did make a sale to that minor. That essentially remained unchanged since 2014, 2015. Again, kind of flattened out. The target was raised in 2014 from 80 to 82%. We're continuing to look at that. We have not been able to do as many minor decoy operations as we would like. Generally, we like to do it between 1,500 and 2,000 per year. This last year, we did 1,000, again, related to the startup of marijuana. A lot of that, too, was liquor regulatory specialists moving into marijuana regulatory positions and vacancies occurring in there, and so just the resource wasn't there to commit to the number of operations we normally do.
So I'll just add here, this is a point at which, you know, if we didn't have the marijuana program, we'd be focusing on doing some of these things better and more. That second visit after a violation is important. You know, you've done a corrective action. You want to make sure that they're staying on course with it. You've had someone that's had a problem. You want to get back there again. We have a low number of visits, relatively low rate of second visits to begin with when you're looking at 20%. So increasing that, I think, is an important compliance piece for the future. We're not asking for more resources here, but if I didn't have marijuana, I'd be talking to you about more resources for alcohol compliance here.
Okay. Senator Monroe.
The new copper penny is gone.
On that cheery note, Ms. Dicer, anything to prepare us for tomorrow?
Same time, same place, Madam Co-Chair.
Same time, same place. All right. Thank you, gentlemen, very kindly. And colleagues, anything for the good of the order? Seeing none, we're adjourned.